I've got to go, he said, standing, and as he left, Jackson followed him. He watched Jude's expression change as he saw Jackson by his side.
J.B., he said calmly, I'm glad to see you. Are you ready to go?
Go where? He asked, stupidly.
Back to my place, said Jude. You said you'd help me reach that box I can't get?
But he was so confused, still so muddled, that he hadn't understood.
What box? The box on the closet shelf that I can't reach, Jude said, still ignoring Jackson. I need your help. It's too difficult for me to climb the ladder on my own.
He should have known then. Jude never made references to what he couldn't do. He was offering him a way out, and he was too stupid to recognize it. But Jackson did.
I think your friend wants you to get away from me, he told J.B., smirking.
That was what Jackson always called them, even though he had met them all before. Your friends. J.B.'s friends. Jude looked at him.
You're right, he said, still in that calm, steady voice. I do.
And then, turning back to him, J.B., won't you come with me? Oh, he wanted to. But in that moment, he couldn't. He wouldn't know why. Not ever. But he couldn't. He was powerless. So powerless that he couldn't even pretend otherwise.
I can't,
he whispered to Jude.
J.B., said Jude, and took his arm and pulled him toward the curb as Jackson watched them with his stupid, mocking smile. Come with me. You don't have to stay here. Come with me, J.B.
He had started crying then. Not loudly, not steadily, but crying nonetheless.
J.B., Jude said again, his voice low. Come with me. You don't have to go back there.
But
I can't,
he heard himself saying.
I can't. I want to go upstairs. I want to go home. Then I'll come in with you. No, no, Jude. I want to be alone. Thank you. But go home. J.B.,
Jude began, but he turned from him and ran, jamming the key into the front door and running up the stairs, knowing Jude wouldn't be capable of following him, but with Jackson right behind him, laughing his mean laugh, while Jude's calls,
J.B., J.B.,
trailed after him, until he was inside his apartment. Jude had cleaned while he was here. The sink was empty, the dishes were stacked in the rack, drying, and couldn't hear him any longer. He turned off his phone, on which Jude was calling him, and muted the front door buzzer's intercom, on which Jude was ringing and ringing him. And then Jackson had cut the lines of coke he had brought, and they had snorted them. And the night had become the same night he'd had hundreds of times before. The same rhythms, the same despair, the same awful feeling of suspension. He is pretty, your friend, he heard Jackson say at some point late that evening. But too bad about... And he stood and did an imitation of Jude's walk, a lurching grotesquerie that looked nothing like it, his mouth slack like a cretin's, his hands bobbling in front of him. He had been too high to protest, too high to say anything at all, and so he had only blinked and watched Jackson hobble around the room, trying to speak words in Jude's defense, his eyes prickling with tears. The next day he had awoken, late, face down on the floor near the kitchen. He stepped around Jackson, who was also asleep on the floor, near his bookcases, and went into his room, where he saw that Jude had made his bed as well, and something about that made him want to cry again. He lifted the plank under the right side of the bed, cautiously, and stuck his hand inside the space. There was nothing there. And so he lay atop the comforter, bringing one end of it over himself completely, covering the top of his head the way he used to when he was a child. As he tried to sleep, he made himself think of why he had fallen in with Jackson. It wasn't that he didn't know why, it was that he was ashamed to remember why. He had begun hanging out with Jackson to prove that he wasn't dependent on his friends, that he wasn't trapped by his life, that he could make and would make his own decisions, even if they were bad ones. By his age, you had met all the friends you would probably ever have. You had met your friends' friends. Life got smaller and smaller. Jackson was stupid and callow and cruel and not the sort of person he was supposed to value, who was supposed to be worth his time. He knew this, and that was why he kept at it, to dismay his friends, to show them that he wasn't bound by their expectations of him. It was stupid, stupid, stupid. It was hubris, and he was the only one who was suffering because of it. "You can't actually like this guy," Willem had said to him once, and although he had known exactly what Willem meant, he had pretended not to, just to be a brat. "Why can't I, Willem?" he'd asked. "He's fucking hilarious. He actually wants to do things. He's actually around when I need someone. Why can't I, huh?" It was the same with the drugs. Doing drugs wasn't hardcore. It wasn't badass. It didn't make him more interesting. But it wasn't what he was supposed to do. These days, if you were serious about your art, you didn't do drugs. Indulgence, the very idea of it, had disappeared, was a thing of the beats and abexes and the ops and the pops. These days, maybe you'd smoke some pot. Maybe every once in a while, if you were feeling very ironic, you might do a line of coke. But that was it. This was an age of discipline, of deprivation, not inspiration. And at any rate, inspiration no longer meant drugs. No one he knew and respected, Richard, Ali, Asian Henry Young, did them. Not drugs, not sugar, not caffeine, not salt, not meat, not gluten, not nicotine. They were artists as ascetics. In his more defiant moments, he tried to pretend to himself that doing drugs was so passé, so tired, that it had actually become cool again. But he knew this wasn't true. Just as he knew it wasn't really true that he enjoyed the sex parties that sometimes convened in Jackson's echoey apartment in Williamsburg, where shifting groups of soft, skinny people groped blindly at one another, and where the first time a boy, too reedy and young and hairless to really be JB's type, told him he wanted JB to watch him suck away his own blood from a cut he'd give himself, he had wanted to laugh. But he hadn't, and had instead watched as the boy cut himself on his bicep and then twisted his neck to lap at the blood, a kitten cleaning itself, and had felt a crush of sorrow. "Oh, JB, I just want a nice white boy," his ex and now friend Toby had once moaned to him, and he smiled a little, remembering it. He did, too. All he wanted was a nice white boy. Not this sad, salamander-like creature, so pale he was almost translucent, licking blood from himself in what had to be the least erotic gesture in the world. But of all the questions he was able to answer, there was one he was not. How was he to get out? How was he to stop? Here he was, literally trapped in his studio, literally peeking down the hallway to make sure Jackson wasn't approaching. How was he to escape Jackson? How was he to recover his life? The night after he had made Jude get rid of his stash, he had finally called him back, and Jude had asked him over, and he had refused, and so Jude had come to him. He had sat and stared at the wall as Jude made him dinner, a shrimp risotto, handing him the plate and then leaning on the counter to watch him eat. "Can I have more?" he asked when he was done with the first serving, and Jude gave it to him. He hadn't realized how hungry he was, and his hand shook as he brought the spoon to his mouth. He thought of Sunday night dinners at his mother's, which he hadn't gone to since his grandmother died. "Aren't you going to lecture me?" he finally asked, but Jude shook his head. After he ate, he sat on the sofa and watched television with the sound turned off, not really seeing anything but comforted by the flash and blur of images, and Jude had washed the dishes and then sat on the sofa near him, working on a brief. One of Willem's movies was on television, the one in which he played a con man in a small Irish town whose entire left cheek was webbed with scars, and he stopped on the channel, not watching it, but looking at Willem's face, his mouth moving silently.
I miss Willem, he'd said,
and then realized how ungrateful he sounded. But Jude had put down his pen and looked at the screen.
I miss him too, he said,
and the two of them stared at their friend, so far away from them.
Don't go, he'd said to Jude as he was falling asleep. Don't leave me.
I won't, Jude had said, and he knew Jude wouldn't. When he woke early the next morning, he was still on the sofa, and the television was turned off, and he was under his duvet. And there was Jude, huddled into the cushions on the other end of the sectional, still asleep. Some part of him had always been insulted by Jude's unwillingness to divulge anything of himself to them, by his furtiveness and secretiveness. But in that moment he felt only gratitude toward and admiration for him, and had sat on the chair next to him, studying his face, which he so loved to paint, his sweep of complicated colored hair, that he could never see without remembering how much mixing, the number of shades it took to accurately represent it.
I can do this, he told Jude, silently. I can do this.
Except he clearly couldn't. He was in his studio, and it was still only 1 p.m., and he wanted to smoke so badly, that in his head all he could see was the pipe, its glass frosted with leftover white powder, and it was only day one of his attempt not to do drugs, and already it was making, he was making, a mockery of him. Surrounding him were the only things he cared about, the paintings in his next series, seconds, minutes, hours, days, for which he had followed Malcolm, Jude, and Willem around for an entire day, photographing everything they did, and then chose 8 to 10 images from each of their days to paint. He had decided to document a typical work day for each of them, all from the same month of the same year, and had labeled each painting with their name, location, and time of day he had shot the image. Willem's series had been the most far-flung. He had gone to London, where Willem had been on location filming something called Latecomers, and the images he had chosen were a mix of Willem off and on the set. He had favorites from each person's take. For Willem, it was Willem, London, October 8, 9:08 a.m., an image of him in the makeup artist's chair, staring at his reflection in the mirror, while the makeup artist held his chin up with the fingertips of her left hand and brushed powder onto his cheeks with her right. Willem's eyes were lowered, but it was still clear that he was looking at himself, and his hands were gripping the chair's wooden arms as if he was on a roller coaster and was afraid he'd fall off if he let go. Before him, the counter was cluttered with wood-shaving curls from freshly sharpened eyebrow pencils that looked like tatters of lace, and open makeup palettes whose every hue was a shade of red, all the reds you could imagine, and wads of tissue with more red smeared on them like blood. For Malcolm, he had taken a long shot of him late at night, sitting at his kitchen counter at home, making one of his imaginary buildings out of squares of rice paper. He liked Malcolm, Brooklyn, October 23, 11:17 p.m., not so much for its composition or color, but for more personal reasons. In college, he had always made fun of Malcolm for those small structures he built and displayed on his windowsill, but really he had admired them, and had liked watching Malcolm compose them. His breath slowed, and he was completely silent, and his constant nervousness, which at times seemed almost physical, an appendage like a tail, fell away. He worked on all of them out of sequence, but he couldn't quite get the colors the way he wanted them for Jude's installment, and so he had the fewest and least of these paintings done. As he'd gone through the photos, he'd noticed that each of his friend's days was defined, glossed, by a certain tonal consistency. He had been following Willem on the days he was shooting in what was supposed to be a large Belgravia flat, and the lighting had been particularly golden, like beeswax. Later, back in the apartment in Notting Hill that Willem was renting, he had taken pictures of him sitting and reading, and there too the light had been yellowish, although it was less like syrup and instead crisper, like the skin of a late fall apple. By contrast, Malcolm's world was bluish. His sterile, white marble countertopped office on 22nd Street, the house he and Sophie had bought in Cobble Hill after they had gotten married. And Jude's was grayish, but a silvery gray, a shade particular to gelatin prints that was proving very difficult to reproduce with acrylics, although for Jude's he had thinned the colors considerably, trying to capture that shimmery light. Before he began, he had to first find a way to make gray seem bright and clean, and it was frustrating because all he wanted to do was paint, not fuss around with colors. But getting frustrated with your paintings, and it was impossible not to think of your work as your colleague and co-participant, as if it was something that sometimes decided to be agreeable and collaborate with you, and sometimes decided to be truculent and unyielding, like a grouchy toddler, was just what happened. You had to keep doing it, and one day you'd get it right. And yet, like his promise to himself, "You're not gonna make it," squealed the taunting, dancing imp in his head. "You're not gonna make it." The paintings were making a mockery of him as well. For this series, he had decided he was going to paint a sequence of one of his days, too. And yet for almost 3 years, he had been unable to find a day worth documenting. He had tried. He had taken hundreds of pictures of himself over the course of dozens of days. But when he reviewed them, they all ended the same way, with him getting high. Or the images would stop in the early evening, and he'd know it was because he'd gotten high, too high to keep taking pictures. And there were other things in those photographs that he didn't like either. He didn't want to include Jackson in a documentation of his life, and yet Jackson was always there. He didn't like the goofy smile he saw on his face when he was on drugs. He didn't like how his face changed from fat and hopeful to fat and avaricious as the day sank into night. This wasn't the version of himself he wanted to paint. But increasingly, he had begun to think this was the version of himself he should paint. This was, after all, his life. This was who he now was. Sometimes he would wake, and it would be dark, and he wouldn't know where he was, or what time it was, or what day it was. Days. Even the very concept of a day had become a mockery. He could no longer accurately measure when one began or ended. "Help me," he'd say aloud in those moments. "Help me." But he didn't know to whom he was addressing his plea, or what he expected to happen. And now he was tired. He had tried. It was 1:30 p.m. on Friday, the Friday of July 4th weekend. He put on his clothes. He closed his studio's windows and locked the door and walked down the stairs of the silent building. "Chen," he said, his voice loud in the stairwell, pretending he was broadcasting a warning to his fellow artists that he was communicating to someone who might need his help. "Chen, Chen, Chen." He was going home. He was going to smoke. He woke to a horrible noise, the noise of machinery, of metal grinding against metal, and started screaming into his pillow to drown it out until he realized it was the buzzer, and then slowly brought himself to his feet and slouched over to the door. "Jackson?" he asked, holding down the intercom button, and he heard how frightened he sounded, how tentative. There was a pause. "No, it's us," said Malcolm. "Let us in." He did. And then they were all there, Malcolm and Jude and Willem, as if they had come to see him perform a show. "Willem," he said, "you're supposed to be in Cappadocia." "I just got back yesterday." "But you're supposed to be gone until," he knew this, "July 6th. That's when you said you'd be back." "It's July 7th. Willem said, quietly. He started to cry then, but he was dehydrated, and he didn't have any tears, just the sounds. July 7th. He had lost so many days. He couldn't remember anything. "JB," said Jude, coming close to him, "we're going to get you out of this. Come with us. We're going to get you help."
Okay,
he said, still crying.
Okay. Okay.
He kept his blanket wrapped around him. He was so cold, but he allowed Malcolm to lead him to the sofa, and when Willem came over with a sweater, he held his arms up obediently, the way he had when he was a child and his mother had dressed him.
Where's Jackson?
He asked Willem.
Jackson's not going to bother you,
he heard Jude say, somewhere above him. Don't worry, J.B.
Willem,
he said,
when did you stop being my friend?
I've never stopped being your friend, J.B., Willem said, and sat down next to him. You know I love you. He leaned against the sofa and closed his eyes. He could hear Jude and Malcolm talking to each other quietly, and then Malcolm walking toward the other end of the apartment, where his bedroom was, and the plank of wood being lifted and then dropped back into place, and the flush of the toilet.
We're ready,
he heard Jude say, and he stood, and Willem stood with him, and Malcolm came over to him and put his arm across his back, and they shuffled as a group toward the door, where he was gripped by a terror. If he went outside, he knew he would see Jackson, appearing as suddenly as he had that day in the cafe.
I can't go,
he said, stopping.
I don't want to go. Don't make me go.
J.B., Willem began. Then something about Willem's voice, about his very presence, made him in that moment irrationally furious, and he shook Malcolm's arm off of him and turned to face them, energy flooding his body.
You don't get a say in what I do, Willem,
he said.
You're never here, and you never supported me, and you never called me, and you don't get to come in making fun of me, poor, stupid, fucked-up J.B. I'm Willem the hero. I'm coming in to save the day, just because you want to, okay? So leave me the fuck alone.
J.B., I know you're upset, Willem said, but no one's making fun of you, least of all me. But before he'd begun speaking, J.B. had seen Willem look over quickly and, it seemed, conspiratorially at Jude, and for some reason this had made him even more livid. What had happened to the days when they all understood one another? When he and Willem had gone out every weekend, when they had returned the next day to share the night stories with Malcolm and Jude, Jude, who never went anywhere, who never shared stories of his own? How had it happened that he was the one who was all alone? Why had they left him for Jackson to pick over and destroy? Why hadn't they fought harder for him? Why had he ruined it all for himself? Why had they let him? He wanted to devastate them. He wanted them to feel as inhuman as he did. And you, he said, turning to Jude,
you like knowing how fucked up I am? You like always being the person who gets to learn everyone else's secrets without ever telling us a single fucking thing? What do you think this is, Jude? You think you get to be a part of the club and you never have to say anything? You never have to tell us anything? Well, it doesn't fucking work like that, and we're all fucking sick of you.
That's enough, J.B., Willem said sharply, grabbing his shoulder. But he was strong suddenly, and he wrenched out of Willem's grasp, his feet unexpectedly nimble, dancing toward the bookcase like a boxer. He looked at Jude, who was standing in silence, his face very still, and his eyes very large, almost as if he was waiting for him to continue, waiting for J.B. to hurt him further. The first time he had painted Jude's eyes, he had gone to a pet store to take photographs of a rough green snake because the colors were so similar. But in that moment, they were darker, almost like a grass snake's, and he wished, ridiculously, that he had his paints, because he knew that if he had them, he'd be able to get the shade exactly right without even having to try.
It doesn't work like that, he said to Jude again.
And then, before he knew it, he was doing Jackson's imitation of Jude, the hideous parody, his mouth open as Jackson had done it, making an imbecile's moan, dragging his right leg behind him as if it were made of stone.
I'm Jude, he slurred. I'm Jude St. Francis.
For a few seconds, his was the only voice in the room, his movements the only movements, and in those seconds he wanted to stop. But he couldn't stop. And then Willem had run at him, and the last thing he had seen was Willem drawing his fist back, and the last thing he had heard was the cracking of bone. He woke and didn't know where he was. It was difficult to breathe. Something was on his nose, he realized. But when he tried to lift his hand to feel what it was, he couldn't. And then he had looked down and seen that his wrists were in restraints, and he knew he was in the hospital. He closed his eyes and remembered. Willem had hit him. Then he remembered why, and he shut his eyes very tightly, howling but not making a noise. The moment passed, and he opened his eyes again. He turned his head to the left, where an ugly blue curtain blocked his view of the door. And then he turned his head to the right, toward the early morning light, and saw Jude, asleep in the chair next to his bed. The chair was too small for him to sleep in, and he had folded himself into a terrible-looking position, his knees drawn up to his chest, his cheek resting atop them, his arms wrapped around his calves. "You know you shouldn't sleep like that, Jude," he told him in his head. "Your back is going to hurt you when you wake up." But even if he could have reached his arm over to wake him, he wouldn't have. "Oh, God," he thought. "Oh, God. What have I done?" "I'm sorry, Jude," he said in his head. And this time he was able to cry properly, the tears running into his mouth, the mucus that he was unable to clean away bubbling over as well. But he was silent. He didn't make any noise. "I'm sorry, Jude. I'm so sorry," he repeated to himself. And then he whispered the words aloud, but quietly, so quietly that he could hear only his lips opening and closing, nothing more. "Forgive me, Jude. Forgive me. Forgive me. Forgive me. Forgive me." Part 4. The Axiom of Equality. Chapter 1. The night before he leaves for Boston for their friend Lionel's wedding, he gets a message from Dr. Lee telling him that Dr. Caution has died. "It was a heart attack, very fast," Dr. Lee writes. "The funeral is Friday afternoon." The next morning he drives directly to the cemetery, and from the cemetery to Dr. Caution's house, a two-story wooden structure in Newton, where the professor used to host a year-end dinner for all of his current graduate students. It was understood that you weren't to discuss math at these parties. "You can talk about anything else," he'd tell them, "but we're not talking about math." Only at Dr. Caution's parties would he be the least socially inept person in the room. He was also, not coincidentally, the least brilliant, and the professor would always make him start the conversation. "So, Jude," he'd say, "what are you interested in these days?" At least two of his fellow graduate students, both of them PhD candidates, had mild forms of autism, and he could see how hard they worked at making conversation, how hard they worked at their table manners. And prior to these dinners, he did some research into what was new in the worlds of online gaming, which one of them loved, and tennis, which the other loved, so he'd be able to ask them questions they could answer. Dr. Caution wanted his students to someday be able to find jobs, and along with teaching them math, he also thought it his responsibility to socialize them, to teach them how to behave among others. Sometimes Dr. Caution's son, Leo, who was 5 or 6 years older than he, would be at dinner as well. He too had autism, but unlike Donald's and McHale's, his was instantly noticeable and severe enough so that although he'd completed high school, he hadn't been able to attend more than a semester of college and had only been able to get a job as a programmer for the phone company, where he sat in a small room day after day, fixing screen after screen of code. He was Dr. Caution's only child, and he still lived at home, along with Dr. Caution's sister, who had moved in after his wife had died years ago. At the house, he speaks to Leo, who seems glazed, and mumbles, looking away from him as he does, and then to Dr. Caution's sister, who was a math professor at Northeastern. "Jude," she says, "it's lovely to see you. Thank you for coming." She holds his hand. "My brother always talked about you, you know. He was a wonderful teacher,"
he tells her. He gave me so much. I'm so sorry. Yes, she says. It was very sudden. And poor Leo. They look at Leo, who is gazing at nothing. I don't know how he's going to deal with this. She kisses him goodbye. Thank you again. Outside, it is fiercely cold, and the windshield is sticky with ice. He drives slowly to Harold and Julia's, letting himself in and calling their names.
And here he is, says Harold, materializing from the kitchen, wiping his hands on a dish towel.
Harold hugs him, which he had begun doing at some point, and as uncomfortable as it makes him, he thinks it'll be more uncomfortable to try to explain why he'd like Harold to stop.
I'm so sorry about caution, Jude. I was shocked to hear it. I ran into him on the courts about 2 months back, and he looked like he was in great shape.
He was, he says, unwinding his scarf as Harold takes his coat. And not that old, either. 74.
Jesus, says Harold, who has just turned 65. There's a cheery thought. Go put your stuff in your room and come into the kitchen. Julia's tied up in a meeting, but she'll be home in an hour or so.
He drops his bag in the guest room. Jude's room, Harold and Julia call it. Your room. And changes out of his suit and heads toward the kitchen, where Harold is peering into a pot on the stove, as if down a well.
I'm trying to make a bolognese, he says, without turning around. But something's happening. Keeps separating, see?
He looks.
How much olive oil did you use?
A lot.
What's a lot?
A lot. Too much, obviously.
He smiles. I'll fix it.
Thank God, says Harold, stepping away from the stove. I was hoping you'd say that.
Over dinner, they speak of Julia's favorite researcher, who she thinks might be trying to jump to another lab, and of the latest gossip circulating through the law school, and of the anthology of essays about Brown versus Board of Education that Harold is editing, and one of Lawrence's twin daughters who is getting married, and then Harold says, grinning,
So, Jude, the big birthday's coming up.
3 months away, Julia chirps, and he groans. What are you going to do?
Probably nothing, he says. He hasn't planned anything, and he has forbidden Willem from planning anything either. 2 years ago, he threw Willem a big party for his 40th at Green Street, and although the four of them had always said they'd go somewhere for each of their 40th birthdays, it hadn't worked out that way. Willem had been in L.A. filming on his actual birthday, but after he had finished, they'd gone to Botswana on a safari. But it had been just the two of them. Malcolm had been working on a project in Beijing, and J.B., well, Willem hadn't mentioned inviting J.B., and he hadn't either.
You have to do something, says Harold. We could have a dinner for you here, or in the city.
He smiles but shakes his head.
40's 40, he says. It's just another year.
As a child, though, he never thought he'd make it to 40. In the months after the injury, he would sometimes have dreams of himself as an adult, and although the dreams were very vague, he was never quite certain where he was living or what he was doing, though in those dreams he was usually walking, sometimes running. He was always young in them. His imagination refused to let him advance into middle age. To change the subject, he tells them about Dr. Koshin's funeral, where Dr. Lee gave a eulogy. People who don't love math always accuse mathematicians of trying to make math complicated, Dr. Lee had said. But anyone who does love math knows it's really the opposite. Math rewards simplicity, and mathematicians value it above all else. So it's no surprise that Walter's favorite axiom was also the most simple in the realm of mathematics, the axiom of the empty set. The axiom of the empty set is the axiom of zero. It states that there must be a concept of nothingness, that there must be the concept of zero, zero value, zero items. Math assumes there's a concept of nothingness, but is it proven? No, but it must exist. And if we are being philosophical, which we today are, we can say that life itself is the axiom of the empty set. It begins in zero and ends in zero. We know that both states exist, but we will not be conscious of either experience. They are states that are necessary parts of life, even as they cannot be experienced as life. We assume the concept of nothingness, but we cannot prove it. But it must exist. So I prefer to think that Walter has not died, but has instead proven for himself the axiom of the empty set, that he has proven the concept of zero. I know nothing else would have made him happier. An elegant mind wants elegant endings, and Walter had the most elegant mind. So I wish him goodbye. I wish him the answer to the axiom he so loved. They are all quiet for a while, contemplating this.
Please tell me that isn't your favorite axiom, Harold says suddenly, and he laughs.
No, he says, it's not. He sleeps in the next day, and that night he goes to the wedding, where, because both of the grooms lived in Hood, he knows almost everyone. The non-Hood guests, Lionel's colleagues from Wellesley and Sinclair's from Harvard, where he teaches European history, stand near one another as if for protection, looking bored and bemused. The wedding is loose-limbed and slightly chaotic. Lionel starts assigning his guests tasks as soon as they arrive, which most of them neglect. He is supposed to be making sure everyone signs the guest book. Willem is supposed to be helping people find their tables, and people walk around saying how, thanks to Lionel and Sinclair, thanks to this wedding, they won't have to go to their 20th reunion this year. They are all here. Willem and his girlfriend, Robin, Malcolm and Sophie, and J.B. and his new boyfriend, whom he hasn't met, and he knows, even before checking their place cards, that they will all be assigned to the same table.
Jude, people he hasn't seen in years say to him, how are you? Where's J.B.?
I just spoke to Willem.
I just saw Malcolm.
And then, are you four all still as close as you were?
We all still talk, he says, and they're doing great,
which is the answer he and Willem had decided they'd give. He wonders what J.B. is saying, whether he is skimming over the truth, as he and Willem are, or whether he is lying outright, or whether, in a fit of J.B.-ish forthrightness, he is telling the truth.
No, we hardly ever speak anymore. I only really talk to Malcolm these days.
He hasn't seen J.B. in months and months. He hears of him, of course, through Malcolm, through Richard, through Black Henry Young. But he doesn't see him any longer, because even nearly 3 years later, he is unable to forgive him. He has tried and tried. He knows how intractable, how mean, how uncharitable he is being. But he can't. When he sees J.B., he sees him doing his imitation of him, sees him confirming in that moment everything he has feared and thought he looks like, everything he has feared and thought other people think about him. But he had never thought his friends saw him like that, or at least he never thought they would tell him. The accuracy of the imitation tears at him, but the fact that it was J.B. doing it devastates him. Late at night, when he can't sleep, the image he sometimes sees is J.B. dragging himself in a half moon, his mouth agape and drooling, his hands held before him in claws.
I'm Jude. I'm Jude St. Francis.
That night, after they had taken J.B. to the hospital and admitted him, J.B. had been stuporous and dribbling when they took him in, but then had recovered and become angry, violent, screaming wordlessly at them all, thrashing against the orderlies, resting his body out of their arms until they had sedated him and dragged him, lolling, down the hallway. Malcolm had left in one taxi, and he and Willem had gone home to Perry Street in another. He hadn't been able to look at Willem in the cab, and without anything to distract him, no forms to fill out, no doctors to talk to, he had felt himself grow cold despite the hot, muggy night, and his hands begin to shake, and Willem had reached over and taken his right hand and held it in his left for the rest of the long, silent ride downtown. He was there for J.B.'s recovery. He decided he'd stay until he got better. He couldn't abandon J.B. then, not after all their time together. The three of them took shifts, and after work he'd sit by J.B.'s hospital bed and read. Sometimes J.B. was awake, but most of the time he wasn't. He was detoxing, but the doctor had also discovered that J.B. had a kidney infection, and so he stayed on in the hospital's main ward,
liquids dripping into his arm, his face slowly losing its bloat. When he was awake, J.B. would beg him for forgiveness, sometimes dramatically and pleadingly, and sometimes, when he was more lucid, quietly. These were the conversations he found most difficult.
"Jude, I'm so sorry," he'd say. "I was so messed up. Please tell me you forgive me. I was so awful. I love you, you know that. I would never want to hurt you. Never." "I know you were messed up, JB," he'd say. "I know. Then tell me you forgive me. Please, Jude."
He'd be silent.
"It's going to be okay, JB," he'd say.
But he couldn't make the words, "I forgive you," leave his mouth. At night, alone, he would say them again and again.
"I forgive you. I forgive you."
It would be so simple, he'd admonish himself. It would make JB feel better. "Say it," he'd command himself as JB looked at him, the whites of his eyes smeary and yellowed.
"Say it."
But he couldn't. He knew he was making JB feel worse. He knew it, and was still unable to say it. The words were stones held just under his tongue. He couldn't release them. He just couldn't. Later, when JB called him nightly from rehab, strident and pedantic, he'd sat silently through his monologues on what a better person he'd become, and how he had realized he had no one to depend on but himself, and how he, Jude, needed to realize that there was more in life than just work, and to live every day in the moment, and learn to love himself. He listened and breathed and said nothing. And then JB had come home and had had to readjust, and none of them heard very much from him at all for a few months. He had lost the lease on his apartment, and had moved back in with his mother while he reestablished his life. But then one day he had called. It had been early February, almost 7 months exactly after they had taken him to the hospital, and JB wanted to see him and talk. He suggested JB meet him at a cafe called Clementine that was near Willem's building, and as he inched his way past the tightly spaced tables to a seat against the back wall, he realized why he had chosen this place. Because it was too small and too cramped for JB to do his impression of him. And recognizing that, he felt foolish and cowardly. He hadn't seen JB in a long time, and JB leaned over the table and hugged him, lightly, carefully, before sitting down.
"You look great," he said. "Thanks," said JB. "So do you."
For 20 minutes or so, they discussed JB's life. He had joined Crystal Meth Anonymous. He was going to live with his mother for another few months or so, and then decide what to do next. He was working again, on the same series he'd been working on before he went away.
"That's great, JB," he'd said. "I'm proud of you."
And then there was a silence, and they both stared at other people. A few tables away from him was a girl wearing a long gold necklace she kept winding and unwinding around her fingers. He watched her talk to her friend, wrapping and unwrapping her necklace, until she looked up at him and he looked away.
"Jude," JB began, "I wanted to tell you, completely sober, that I'm so sorry. It was horrible.
He shook his head.
"It was so cruel. I can't—"
He stopped again, and there was a silence.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I'm sorry." "I know you are, JB," he said.
And he felt a sort of sadness he'd never felt before. Other people had been cruel to him, had made him feel awful, but they hadn't been people he loved. They hadn't been people he had always hoped saw him as someone whole and undamaged. JB had been the first. And yet JB had also been one of the first to be his friend. When he'd had the episode in college that had made his roommates take him to the hospital where he'd met Andy, it had been JB, Andy later told him, who had carried him in. And JB, who had demanded that he be seen first, who had made such an upset in the ER that he had been ejected, but not before a doctor had been summoned. He could see JB's love for him in his paintings of him. He remembered one summer in Truro, watching JB sketch, and he had known from the expression on J.B.'s face, his little smile, and a lingering, delicate way his large forearm moved over the page, that he was drawing something he treasured, something that was dear to him. "What are you drawing?" he'd asked. And J.B. had turned to him and held up the notepad, and he had seen it was a picture of him, of his face. "Oh, J.B.," he thought. "Oh, I will miss you." "Can you forgive me, Jude?" J.B. asked, and looked at him. He didn't have the words. He could only shake his head. "I can't, J.B.," he said finally. "I can't. I can't look at you without seeing..." He stopped. "I can't," he repeated. "I'm sorry, J.B. I'm so sorry." "Oh," said J.B., and he swallowed. They sat there for a long time, not saying anything. "I'll always want wonderful things for you," he said to J.B., who nodded slowly, not looking at him. "Well," J.B. said, finally, and stood, and he stood as well, and held his hand out to J.B., who looked at it as if it were something alien, something he'd never seen before, examining it, squinting at it. And then at last he took it, but instead of shaking it, he lowered his lips to it and held them there. And then J.B. returned his hand to him and bumbled, nearly ran out of the cafe, bumping against the little tables. "Sorry, sorry," as he went. He still sees J.B. now and then, mostly at parties, always in groups, and the two of them are polite and cordial with each other. They make small talk, which is the most painful thing. J.B. has never tried to hug or kiss him again. He comes over to him with his hand already outstretched, and he takes it, and they shake. He sent J.B. flowers, but with only the briefest of notes, when seconds, minutes, hours, days opened. And although he skipped the opening, he had gone to the gallery the following Saturday on his way up to work, where he had spent an hour moving slowly from one painting to the next. J.B. had planned on including himself in this series, but in the end he hadn't. There was just him and Malcolm and Willem. The paintings were beautiful, and as he looked at each, he thought not so much of the lives depicted in them as of the life who created them. So many of these paintings were done when J.B. was at his most miserable, his most helpless, and yet they were self-assured and subtle. And to see them was to imagine the empathy and tenderness and grace of the person who made them. Malcolm has remained friends with J.B., although he felt the need to apologize to him for this fact. "Oh, no, Malcolm," he'd said, once Malcolm had confessed, asking him for his permission. "You should absolutely still be friends with him. He doesn't want J.B. to be abandoned by them all. He doesn't want Malcolm to feel he has to prove his loyalty to him by disavowing J.B. He wants J.B. to have a friend who's known him since he was 18, since he was the funniest, brightest person in the school, and he and everyone else knew it. But Willem has never spoken to J.B. again. Once J.B. returned from rehab, he called J.B. and said that he couldn't be friends with him any longer, and that J.B. knew why. And that had been the end. He had been surprised by this, and saddened, because he had always loved watching J.B. and Willem laugh together and spar with each other, and loved having them tell him about their lives. They were both so fearless, so bold. They were his emissaries to a less inhibited, more joyful world. They had always known how to take pleasure from everything, and he had always admired that in them, and had been grateful that they had been willing to share it with him. "You know, Willem," he said once, "I hope the reason you're not talking to J.B. isn't because of what happened to me." "Of course it's because of what happened to you," Willem had said. "But that's not a reason," he'd said. "Of course it is," Willem had said. "There's no better reason than that." He had never done it before, and so he had no real understanding of how slow and sad and difficult it was to end a friendship. Richard knows that he and J.B. and Willem and J.B. don't talk any longer, but he doesn't know why, or at least not from him. Now, years later, he no longer even blames J.B. He simply cannot forget.
He finds that some small but unignorable part of him is always wondering if JB will do it again. He finds he is scared of being left alone with him. 2 years ago, the first year JB didn't come up to Truro, Harold asked him if anything was the matter.
"You never talk about him anymore," he said.
"Well," he began, not knowing how to continue, we're not really
friends any longer, Harold."
"I'm sorry, Jude," Harold said after a silence, and he nodded.
"Can you tell me what happened?"
"No," he said, concentrating on snapping the tops off the radishes. "It's a long story."
"Can it be repaired, do you think?"
He shook his head.
"I don't think so."
Harold sighed.
"I'm sorry, Jude," he repeated.
"It must be bad."
He was quiet. "I always loved seeing you four together, you know. You had something special."
He nodded again.
"I know," he said. "I agree. I miss him."
"He misses JB still. He expects he always will. He especially misses JB at events like this wedding, where the four of them would once have spent the night talking and laughing about everyone else, enviable and near obnoxious in their shared pleasure, their pleasure in one another. But now there are JB and Willem nodding at each other across the table, and Malcolm talking very fast to try to obscure any tension, and the other three people at the table, whom the four of them, he will always think of them as the four of them, the four of us, start interrogating with inappropriate intensity, laughing loudly at their jokes, using them as unwitting human shields. He is seated next to JB's boyfriend, the nice white boy he has always wanted, who is in his 20s and has just gotten his nursing degree and is clearly besotted with JB.
"What was JB like in college?" asks Oliver, and he says, "Very much the way he is today, funny and sharp and outrageous and smart and talented. He was always, always talented."
"Hmm," says Oliver thoughtfully, looking over at JB, who is listening to Sophie with what seems like exaggerated concentration.
"I never think of JB as funny, really."
And then he looks over at JB as well, wondering if Oliver has perhaps interpreted JB incorrectly, or whether JB has, in fact, become someone else, someone he now wouldn't recognize as the person he knew for so many years. At the end of the night, there are kisses and handshakes, and when Oliver, to whom JB has clearly told nothing, tells him they should get together, the three of them, because he's always wanted to get to know him, one of JB's oldest friends, he smiles and says something vague and gives JB a wave before heading outside, where Willem is waiting for him.
"How was it for you?" Willem asks.
"Okay," he says, smiling back at him.
He thinks these meetings with JB are even harder for Willem than they are for him.
"You?"
"Okay," Willem says.
His girlfriend drives up to the curb. They are staying at a hotel.
"I'll call you tomorrow, all right?"
Back in Cambridge, he lets himself into the silent house and walks as softly as he can back to his bathroom, where he prizes his bag from beneath the loose tile near the toilet and cuts himself until he feels absolutely empty, holding his arms over the bathtub, watching the porcelain stain itself crimson. As he always does after seeing JB, he wonders if he has made the right decision. He wonders if all of them, he, Willem, JB, Malcolm, will lie awake that night longer than usual, thinking of one another's faces and of conversations, good and bad, that they have had with one another over what had been more than 20 years of friendship.
"Oh," he thinks, "if I were a better person, if I were a more generous person, if I were a less self-involved person, if I were a braver person."
Then he stands, gripping the towel bar as he does. He has cut himself too much tonight, and he is faint. He goes over to the full-length mirror that is hung on the back of the bedroom's closet door. In his apartment on Green Street, there are no full-length mirrors.
"No mirrors," he told Malcolm. "I don't like them.
but really he doesn't want to be confronted with his image. He doesn't want to see his body, his face staring back at him. But here at Harold and Julia's, there is a mirror, and he stands in front of it for a few seconds, contemplating himself, before adopting the hunched pose J.B. had that night. J.B. was right, he thinks. He was right. And that is why I can't forgive him. Now he drops his mouth open. Now he hops in a little circle. Now he drags his leg behind him. His moans fill the air in the quiet, still house. The last Saturday in May, he and Willem have what they've been calling the last supper at a tiny, very expensive sushi restaurant near his office on 56th Street. The restaurant has only 6 seats, all at a wide, velvety cypress counter, and for the 3 hours they spend there, they are the only patrons. Although they both knew how much the meal would cost, they're both stunned when they look at the check, and then both start laughing, though he's not sure if it's the absurdity of spending so much on a single dinner, or the fact that they have, or the fact that they can that is to blame. "I'll get it," Willem says, but as he's reaching for his wallet, a waiter comes over to him with his credit card, which he'd given to him when Willem was in the bathroom. "God damn it, Jude," Willem says, and he grins. "It's the last supper, Willem," he says. "You can get me a taco when you come back." "If I come back," Willem says. It has been their running joke. "Jude, thank you. You weren't supposed to pay for this." It's the first warm night of the year, and he tells Willem that if he really wants to thank him for dinner, he'll walk with him. "How far?" asks Willem, warily. "We're not going to walk all the way down to Soho, Jude." "Not far." "It had better not be," Willem says, "because I'm really tired." This is Willem's new strategy, and he is very fond of it. Instead of telling him he can't do certain things because it's not good for his legs or back, Willem instead tries to make himself sound incapable in order to dissuade him. These days, Willem is always too tired to walk, or too achy, or too hot, or too cold, but he knows that these things are untrue. One Saturday afternoon, after they'd gone to some galleries, Willem had told him he couldn't walk from Chelsea to Green Street, "I'm too tired," and so they had taken a cab instead. But then the next day at lunch, Robin had said, "Wasn't it a beautiful day yesterday? After Willem got home, we ran for, what, 8 miles, right, Willem? All the way up and down the highway." "Oh, did you?" he asked her, looking at Willem, who smiled sheepishly at him. "What can I say?" he said. "I unexpectedly got a second wind." They start walking south, first veering east from Broadway so they won't have to cross through Times Square. Willem's hair has been colored dark for his next role, and he has a beard, so he's not instantly recognizable, but neither of them wants to get stuck in a scrum of tourists. This is the last time he will see Willem for what will likely be more than 6 months. On Tuesday, he leaves for Cyprus to begin work on the Iliad and the Odyssey. He will play Odysseus in both. The two films will be shot consecutively and released consecutively, but they will have the same cast and the same director, too. The shoot will take him all across southern Europe and northern Africa before moving to Australia, where some of the battle scenes are being shot, and because the pace is so intense and the distances he has to travel so far, it's unclear whether he'll have much time, if any, to come home on breaks. It is the most elaborate and ambitious shoot Willem has been on, and he is nervous. "It's going to be incredible, Willem," he reassures him. "Or an incredible disaster," Willem says. He isn't glum, he never is, but he can tell Willem is anxious and eager to do well and worried that he will somehow disappoint. But he is worried before every film, and yet, as he reminds Willem, every one has turned out fine, better than fine. However, he thinks, this is one of the reasons that Willem will always have work, and good work, because he does take it seriously, because he does feel so responsible. He, though, is dreading the next 6 months, especially because Willem has been so present for the last year and a half. First, he was shooting a small project, one based in Brooklyn, that lasted just a few weeks,
and then